On today's program, my special guest is Scott Stabile. We're talking about his best-selling book, Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversation begins now. I'm so glad you joined us today. You know, if anyone had a right to curl up in a ball and give up, it's Scott Stabile. His parents were murdered when he was 14, and 9 years later, his brother died of a heroin overdose. He joined a cult and wrenched himself out of it after 13 years. But all the while, Stabile was learning to do things like forgive the man who murdered his parents, have compassion for his brother, and believe in the power of love to create positive change above all else. Wow, in this great best-selling book, Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart, he shares a personal experience that pulled him from his center and the ways in which he brought himself back to peace and to love. He writes about all of these experiences in ways that are universally applicable, uplifting, and sometimes even laugh out loud funny. Scott Stabile is the author of this book and a few other books he's written in the past. His inspirational posts and videos have attracted a huge and devoted social media following, including over 350,000 Facebook fans and counting, by the way. A regular contributor to the Huffington Post, he lives in the beautiful state of Michigan and conducts personal empowerment workshops around the world. You can visit him online at scottstabile, STABILE.com, and he's joining us from that beautiful state right now. Scott Stabile, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
You know, I've always believed that some people succeed in spite of handicaps and others succeed because of them, but often the truth is our problems can help us make us what we are, or even our challenges, and you certainly had a life full of those. So my question for you is, in this beautiful book, Big Love, you say, nothing stands to transform us, our relationships and the world, more than a commitment to live our lives from love. I love that statement you made. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'm always happy to talk about love. Well, when I speak about love, I'm speaking about the energy of love, yeah, which is, as I see it, the thing that informs, you know, all the most important things in the world, like kindness and compassion and forgiveness and authenticity. Those are all love in action. So in my experience, when I'm operating from that energy, when I'm connecting to the love inside of me and interacting with others through that energy and interacting with myself in a loving way, I am, you know, that's the most powerful and positive thing I can do for myself and all involved. And I think we all know that on an intuitive level, because we all know what it's like to move through the world with a loving heart. Not all the time, you know, certainly, and I'm not always in that loving space, but sure, we know that when we are, we're contributing to whatever's going on in a positive way. And we also have all experienced being on the receiving end of loving energy, and we know the power that that carries. So that's, you know, that's really one of the core, my core messages in the writing and speaking I do, is just as often as possible, you know, ask yourself the question, what does love invite me to do in this moment? You know, how is love inviting me to respond to this situation?
Yeah.
And the, you know, the more we're able to sink into that place, I think the better off we all are.
Absolutely. I so agree with you. You also say, and I love this, that we can be love spreaders. What would that look like on a daily basis, Scott?
It looks like a lot of things, I think. It looks like when you wake up and you go into the bathroom and then you look at yourself in the mirror, and you're in that self-abusive place where you're like, I'm too fat, or I'm too skinny, or I'm too bald, or I'm too this, or not enough that, bringing awareness to the moment of that self-abuse and interrupting it and offering yourself loving statements. I mean, that is love in action. That's how you're spreading love.
Yeah.
When you go out into the world and you're in interacting with your neighbors or people in the store, are you showing up with kindness? Because every time we show up with kindness, we're spreading love.
Mm.
You know, when you're reading statements on social media that infuriate you or offend you or disgust you, are you taking the time to remember that this is another human being on the other side of these comments, and that whatever has happened in their lives, whatever struggles they've overcome, mm-hmm, whatever experiences they've had, that's what's playing into them writing this stuff. Can you bring empathy to the moment instead of responding in vitriol? Mm-hmm. Can you make whatever point you feel compelled to make, but with compassion and with empathy? Because that's love in action. I mean, the day is filled from the moment we woke up to the moment we go to bed with opportunities to spread love.
It really is. And I was thrilled when I read that in your book, your take on that, because I've come to believe myself the same thing, Scott, that if each individual, just each individual, forget these big movements with the charismatic leaders, if each individual would simply show love and kindness through their ordinary day to the people that cross their path, we would probably have a revolution.
Yeah, hallelujah, man. Absolutely. I agree with you 100% in that. And people write me often with this comment in question. Basically, mm-hmm. I feel so overwhelmed by the state of the world, and I feel so paralyzed. Like, in that overwhelm and paralysis has us believing that we can't really contribute, we can't really make a difference, because how are we going to make a difference in whether we go to war with North Korea or whether, you know, all of these nightmarish, violent things that are happening in the world. But I really believe that we make a difference in exactly what you said. How are we showing up with loving kindness to the people in our lives, to the people we're encountering in the day-to-day? How are we being of service in that way? And we find that that's when I feel that that's what takes me out of that hopeless, overwhelmed feeling.
Yeah.
Is when I just get out into the world, into my community, and connect, you know, and remember that we are all so much more similar than we are different. And it's profound.
Well,
it matters.
And it's being committed to that wide open heart, part of your subtitle of this book, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, look, I everything I wrote in the book and everything I talk about is, I try to always remember to tell people I'm speaking from my own experience, and even though I believe it applies to a lot of experiences because we're all so similar, but in my experience, and this comes from, you know, many years of not living with the open heart that I feel like I'm living with today, but when I shifted and recognized that the more open I am to honest connection, to connection that is rooted in vulnerability and in truth, the more light and love and deeper connections I bring into my life.
Yeah.
And I really believe that's the case for all of us.
One of the things I've appreciated about you, Scott, is, first of all, with social media, I've always felt like it can be a two-edged sword. It can be used to hurt, and it can be used to heal. You've built quite a social media presence, my friend, including over 350,000 followers on your Facebook. Can you share with my listeners about the progression of that, how that came to be?
Sure. Well, I started the page about maybe five and a half years ago, and I actually started the page because I had written this children's film, and the PR guy on the film said, listen, you should maybe start an author page, a writer page, and you can engage with fans of the film and promote the film. The film was a monumental flop, so there were no fans really. And
was that the Oogie Loves and the Big Balloon Adventure? Yeah, okay.
Exactly. It was an epic box office.
Okay.
But this is one of those moments in life, because when I was reflecting back on it, when I was writing the chapter about the Oogie Loves, I was like, the whole reason my Facebook page exists is because of that movie, because I might never have started the page if I had, you know, written that movie. And then, so suddenly I'm sitting there with my page and I'm thinking, well, what do I want to write about for real? Like, what would I like to write about on this page? And I started to, you know, write about love and kindness and all of these thoughts. And at first it was just, I was writing all very positive, very sunshiny, unicorn, rainbow type stuff, because I wanted it to be a place that would just, whoever, you know, tuned in, they'd get a jolt of positivity and could go on with their day. Mm-hmm. And then a woman left a comment under one of my posts, and she wrote, you know, Scott, not everyone is as happy as you are all the time. Some of us are really struggling out here.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a wake-up call for me, because I realized that there was really no reason for this woman to believe that I wasn't always happy all the time because that's all I had shared on the page. Mm-hmm. And it was, I saw it as an invitation to share more about myself and about my story and more of my insecurities and my fears, as well as my joys and triumphs and, you know, the full spectrum of experience. And once I started doing that, the energy of the page really started to shift and grow. And and I found that the posts where I was, you know, maybe sharing an insecurity and what I've learned in working through that or being present with it, those were the posts that always got the most comments. And the comments were all in the line of me too and thank you, it's so good to know I'm not alone and I want you to know you're not alone in what you're experiencing. And the page really started to feel a bit more like a community then, you know, and I found that it's, you know, I believe that that it's grown in part because I've, one, I do believe there's value in positivity, you know, not at the expense of being real, but in just recognizing that our minds naturally go to a negative place. And if we're going to spend our time being negative and thinking of all the negative outcomes, it serves us to at least give, you know, half the time to considering the benefits of a situation as well.
Yeah.
And so along with keeping an overall positive tone, I feel like the page has grown a lot because I share myself and I share myself, you know, as honestly as I'm able in the moment. And I think that other people recognize that though you may not have my exact same experiences, we're all human beings. We all know grief. We all know loss. We all know heartbreak.
Yeah.
You know, we all know what it means to want love in our lives. And it's there's something really cathartic in feeling less alone in connecting to someone else's experience.
That is so true. Having been on the Facebook page and having read this book, it's really Big Love is about keeping it real. And that's one of the things I appreciate so much about you. There are so many people out there that just paint that rosy picture. Your life has not been that. And you've risked and been vulnerable in sharing both, sharing the positive, which I think is beautiful because you also came out of so much in your life. And speaking of that, your parents were murdered when you were just 14. And first of all, that's hard to wrap my head around just right there. So the question is, I'm sure everyone asks you, how did losing them in such a violent way, and especially at such a young age, Scott, how did it impact your life and your dedication to live your life from love?
Well, I mean, as far as how it impacted my life, that at the time, I mean, it completely uprooted my life, of course. I moved in with my eldest sister and her family to a new school and started a new life in a new high school, which was overwhelming on its own, let alone dealing with the loss of my parents. And the only way I dealt with it at the point, and it wasn't even a conscious choice, but when I reflect back on it, I'm so grateful that something in me knew to do this, is I just buried it. I literally locked away the reality of my parents' loss and the way they were shot to death. And I, you know, once a year, for several years, once a year I'd have a good cry and I'd lock it away again, and I just was a good student and had friends, and I created a big secret around the fact that I was an orphan. I manipulated conversations away from talking about families so that people wouldn't find out. And, you know, it took a lot of energy, but I didn't want to be, I was a teenager. I didn't want to be a freak and I didn't want to be pitied. And it wasn't really until when I was in my early 20s and moved to San Francisco after college and started to recognize that this wall that I had built around my story with the loss of my parents, and at the same time around my sexuality as a gay man, it was creating walls in my connections with people. You know, we like to believe that we can just put up a wall to the darkness without affecting the light, but that's not really how walls work. If you're putting up walls, you're putting up walls. And it was in my 20s that I started to recognize, you know what, I need to grieve my parents in a different way, which really just meant allowing for grieving, like allowing for crying more than once a year and allowing for the rage that I felt inside that I'd never given it an outlet. you know, because we can be masters at burying our emotions. Mm. And I'd never given an outlet for the rage and for all the sadness I felt. And so in my 20s, I started to, and it was profound, and I started to open up more. And I started to also, at the same time, I was connecting to people and reading books that were focused on love as a driving force in your life. So that was really when I was coming into this understanding that, you know, the more often I'm operating for the love, from love, the more I'm serving myself. And in the grieving process, I think that we're taught to believe that there are rules around grief and that you have to go through specific cycles and you have to do it a certain way. And, you know, I just realized that that's not how grief works.
Yeah.
You know, there really aren't rules.
Yeah.
And you don't have to do it any specific way, but we're certainly served by allowing ourselves to grieve, mm-hmm. you know, by allowing ourselves to feel whatever feelings are coming up. And though it served me really well in my teenage years and young adult years to bury it, mm-hmm. I was much more profoundly served when I really started to just cry and feel mm-hmm. and move forward that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then reflecting now, to answer your question also, is when I look at how losing my parents has, the gifts that have come from having experienced something so tragic and horrible, is that I feel like I'm way more compassionate than I ever might have been, I suspect, and way more empathetic. And I think that's one of the gifts of sadness and loss, is that we're able, if we're willing, we're able to show up for others who are going through, you know, loss and grief in a completely different way when we've experienced it ourselves. And that's been a big gift. And also the recognition, you know, when we've all, or if you're an adult, you have overcome something. You know, you've probably experienced loss, you've experienced struggle, and only by overcoming things and moving forward in your life, despite whatever you've experienced, only then do you really see how strong and resilient you are inside, you know. And it's when you haven't had to overcome anything, you're not really aware of the strength that lives within you. So that's been another gift.
What an honor it is to have Scott Stabile on today's program. I have so enjoyed his book. You probably have read it by now. If you haven't, you need to pick up a copy. The title is Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart. And Scott, before the break, we were talking about the effect that the murder had on you when you were only 14, the murder of your parents. How were you also ultimately able to forgive the man who murdered your parents?
I mean, in a word, empathy.
Yeah.
You know, and that wasn't, you know, it wasn't my intention to forgive him at first. That was the last thing on my mind. But I noticed that, you know, when I was thinking about the man who murdered my parents, it was always with a very, you know, with rage and bitterness and blame and all of these emotions that never feel good to feel. And I realized that if I want to move beyond those emotions, I need to make myself open to the possibility of forgiveness. And I started to consider his life, or what I imagined his life to be like. I tried to imagine his struggle. I connected to the reality that no one who was operating from any place of self-love and self-worth could ever murder other people. It's just not possible. And though I couldn't connect to murdering other people, I could connect to feeling really unworthy and really unloved, and I could connect to being so angry in moments that you wished people would die. Like, all of these things are human things that we all know it to some degree. And it was only then that I, you know, connecting to his humanity, remembering he was a human being who made a really horrible choice, but he was a human being.
Yes.
And then I recognized that when I started to think about him, it was with forgiveness. You know, it wasn't like a moment where I said, I forgive him. I don't think that's how forgiveness works. I don't think we can just declare it and it is. I think but I recognize that by doing the work of empathy and compassion, that forgiveness found me eventually.
Mm, that's a powerful statement right there. Yeah, absolutely. And I would imagine with everything going on in this world, and especially in this country with the violence taking place, with the shootings that are taking place, that forgiveness is such a need for so many people right now.
Oh, yeah. And desperately. And I think that, unfortunately, we're still conditioned to see so many things as unforgivable,
mm-hmm.
you know,
right,
and if you view something as unforgivable, you can't find your way to forgiveness with it. And if you choose to move through your life viewing certain things in your life as unforgivable, which I understand that inclination, but the reality is then you're never really free from that experience. You know, that was the other thing I learned about forgiveness is forgiveness equals freedom. You know, when I, the moment I forgave that man and with the other people I've forgiven in my life for reasons I felt that they needed to be forgiven, it's like you are released from that toxic feeling of hate and mm-hmm. blame and all of it. Mm-hmm. It's a ticket to freedom, unlike many things.
Mm. You also spent 13 years in what you described as a cult. What compelled you to be a part of it, and why did you finally decide to walk away from it?
Well, what compelled me to be a part of it was this was the time in my early mid-20s again when I moved to San Francisco and was reading all these books in the spiritual, new age, self-help world, and I was meeting a lot of people, really wonderful people who were talking a lot about enlightenment and, you know, ideas that I hadn't ever really heard of or considered, but that made a lot of sense to me, you know, the ideas of making your focus in life being more loving rather than like what you're going to do for work mm-hmm. and really focusing on these important aspects of being a human being. And a lot of these people I was meeting, they were all students of a guru. And it was only a matter of time before I met this teacher and was really drawn to him and really loved these new friends in my life. So I eventually, you know, joined his community, which is, I do believe is a cult. And, you know, in great part because I loved what I was hearing. It was a lot of talk about unconditional love and unconditional friendship and looking honestly at the darker parts, the shadow side, mm-hmm. to be more real in the world. And all of these beautiful ideas that I completely resonate with still today. But what I came to feel was that the guru who professed himself to be an enlightened master without any ego wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, I worked hard to believe that he was, even when he would say and do things that seemed really egomaniacal. I just would continuously tell myself, well, you know, Scott, you're not enlightened, so you don't know what enlightenment looks like, and trust and trust and trust. But eventually, I couldn't make myself believe that he was who he said he was mm-hmm. any longer, you know, mm-hmm. and it took me about a year from that realization to actually walk away because I knew that by walking away, there was a good chance I would lose this community of friends who were, by this time, my family. I mean, these were the closest people to me in my life.
Yeah.
And I did lose them all. They all, like, you know, he instructed them to delete me from their lives, and that mm-hmm. was very painful and traumatic. And but I know I've never regretted the choice. I know it was the right choice for me. I believe that I still miss things about that community and the people in it, and I believe that, you know, the leader has a lot of love in his heart and mm-hmm. is also really manipulative and delusional. Like, mm-hmm. I think both those things are true,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I don't regret moving on from that experience at all.
Yeah. You know, another word that seems to be becoming more in the media these days is the word shame. And what have you learned about moving beyond shame? Because for so many who are experiencing that, it's tough to move out of.
Oh, man, shame is one of the hardest. And we all know shame, every single one of us. And we all know it from a young age. And it just builds upon itself. And, you know, the way I found to move beyond my shame is to announce it. That is like mm-hmm. kind of the foolproof way to get beyond shame, because in my experience, shame thrives on secrecy. You know, shame needs us to keep things secret in order for the shame to survive. And that's exactly what we do with those things we're ashamed of. Generally, we don't want anyone to know about them. So we're hiding our shameful parts, you know. And what I found in my life, I mean, I'll use my sexuality as an example, because that's been the thing I felt the most shame about in my life, being a gay man. And it wasn't until, I think a lot of people in the LGBT community would agree with this, but it transcends the LGBT community, is it wasn't until I started to come out, and at first to very close friends of mine, because it was the biggest secret I was keeping, and suddenly you share it with one person, and, you know, a person you can trust and you think will receive it well, and that person did, and it's like 10,000 pounds of weight lifting off your shoulders.
Yeah.
And you share it with the next person, and you start to realize, and not just around sexuality, take anything you feel ashamed of. I was super ashamed of losing my hair early in college, and I always hid underneath a baseball cap, you know. And we're ashamed of things about our physical appearance,
yes.
Ashamed of our intelligence. We're ashamed of so many things.
Mm-hmm.
But you find that the moment you can find someone to start sharing those things you're ashamed of, you're going to realize a few things, most likely. One is that they're carrying something that's very similar that they're ashamed of, too, that your shame is likely universal. And that realization alone dissipates the power that shame has on you.
Yeah.
And the moment you start to speak it and announce it, you just, the weight that the shame carries, it releases. That's been my experience time and time and time again. And what you do by announcing your shame is you create a space for other people to feel more comfortable to share those things they feel ashamed of. And suddenly, there are more and more and more of us who are simply recognizing that we're human.
Mm-hmm.
It's human to feel shame, and all the things we feel ashamed of are also human.
Yes.
And that's okay, you know, and they don't have to direct our lives. And I think that there are a lot of, you know, I'm inspired most by, you know, writers, speakers, people with podcasts who are addressing these things and talking about them and sharing the things in their life they felt ashamed of or feel ashamed of, because it gives us all permission to do the same.
Yeah, I so agree. So whether it be shame or grief or something else someone is dealing with, can you talk, Scott, a little bit about writing as a tool to process pain? It's very effective, isn't it?
I think writing is one of the best tools. I mean, and look, I have a book out, obviously, but I don't even mean writing books or anything like that. I'm just talking about anyone out there, if you know how to write, you can, you know, pick up a journal and start writing. And I found that especially with sadness, especially with rage, when you can get that stuff out on the page, it's energetically getting it out of your body.
Mm-hmm.
And there's power in that. But what I've so often found with writing too is if I'm feeling confused about something, really upset about something, someone's, you know, angered or offended me or really hurt my feelings, when I start writing about it, there's something that happens in the process of writing. And I think especially for me with pen to paper, but mm-hmm. it works on the computer too, is where I start with my writing, I get to a place often that I don't feel I would have gotten to if I had just been thinking about things in my head. There's something that happens in the act of writing it down on paper. The process of self-exploration and self-discovery, I've been able to kind of uncover things about myself through writing that were these aha moments that I didn't get myself to just by thought. I think that writing is a very, very powerful tool for all of us if we approach it, you know, with as much openness as possible for self-exploration and healing.
Mm-hmm. You also write a lot about fear. What steps have you taken, Scott, to become less fearful in your life?
Well, you know what? I don't even know that I'm much less fearful. I'm just way more courageous than I've ever been.
I like that.
Really,
okay.
Like, and I really think that's been one of the lessons I've learned about fear. Is so often in my life, I told myself, "Well, when I become fearless, I'll do that thing that I'm afraid to do." But we don't become fearless. That isn't what usually happens. I don't even often become less afraid. And then I started to just realize that it's not really about losing my fear. It's about recognizing that I can be afraid and still move forward and still make these brave choices in my life. Mm-hmm. And that by doing so, I start to establish a different relationship with my fear. Mm-hmm. Not one where it bullies me, as I've often felt. Not one where I feel like my fear is the main thing preventing me from living, you know, a positive, productive life. But one where I recognize that my fear is only here to protect me. That's its job. And it sees anything as even a remote threat or discomfort as a reason for me not to move forward. So I don't give as much credit to my fear's voice, because I know that it's here to protect me, but that it's also kind of stupid. And it's like it would approach me entering into a difficult conversation with the same energy that it would approach me running into a burning fire. It sees both things as uncomfortable. Avoid them. Don't do it. You know, and so now I look at my fear more like this annoying 5-year-old brother who's tugging on your pants and like, don't do that, don't do that. And so I say to my fear now, like, just, you know, I hear you. And I know you're just doing what you need to do. And then I move forward anyway.
Yeah.
And make brave choices. And it really does matter how we relate to our fear in terms of how much power it has over the choices we make in our lives.
Mm. Scott, it seems like, and we've witnessed this in politics, we saw this really in a recent election in Alabama, there seems to be a great cultural divide in our country. Here you are, a gay man. Here you are, best-selling author, dude. Forget that featured film that bombed. You got a book that's really hot, Big Love. My question is, how does the fact that you're gay impact the messages you share with all your fans, regardless of where they're coming from?
You know, I think if the fact that I'm gay impacts, I think the people it would likely impact the most would be other LGBT people out there who see me just being super open about the fact that I'm gay and, you know, talking about my partner and just, you know, open about my life in that way. And I've received messages from gay people who wrote to me and said, you know, thank you for helping me be more comfortable with my sexuality in my life. But other than that, I don't know that I'm just trying to be who I am in the world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just
yeah.
being honest about my experience in the world. And so my sexuality is a part of that experience. My relationship is a part of that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, I just hope it encourages people to be, you know, more open and honest with whatever it is their experience of life is.
Well, it gets back to what you talked about earlier in this conversation. It's having the courage just to be authentic, to be who you are.
Absolutely. There are a few things. A few people have asked me, you know, what would you say to your 16-year-old self? And I've seen that question a lot. It gets asked a lot. And the thing that always comes to me with that question is like, be who you are as much as you are possibly able, because human beings are judgmental and you're going to be judged no matter what you do. So let people judge you for your truth if they're going to judge you, because there's no saying, you know, how much possibility you create in your world and just how much freer and better you feel about the life you're living when you're living an honest life as much as possible.
Yeah. Well, speaking of politics again, has this intensely divided political environment shifted your priorities? And if so, how? And I'm wondering, do you have some tips on how we can communicate better with one another about politics? Because there's a lot of families out there that are literally divided because of politics.
I know. I think it's a tough one, and I certainly haven't mastered it. I've worked really hard on it. I mean, you know, the election of this president has provoked a lot of soul searching in me, because I stand behind my commitment to love and to being a loving person, and the political arena as it is right now has provoked a lot of dark thoughts, you know, and a lot of thoughts that are not in any way loving. And I know that's okay, and I know that's normal, but I also don't want to show up to dialogues from that place, because I don't think it ultimately serves any potential for connection or even for just respect.
Yeah.
And so to people, like I would say to people, if someone posts something, for instance, because I think that's one thing we can most of us can relate to, someone posting something on Facebook or social media that you can't believe they posted it, it offends you, it disgusts you, it enrages you. You know, I don't respond if I don't have anything to offer but vitriol. You know, if I can show up to the dialogue and remember that this is a human being on the other side, that their life experiences have brought them to the place of posting this, and though I don't agree with what they're saying or condone what they're saying in any way, if I can't still show up with empathy and compassion in my response, I don't respond because I don't feel the need to fuel the fire that's already burning out of control by adding my own rage and vitriol. I don't think that that serves the conversation. At the same time, sometimes people are committed to their hate. And if you're on the opposite end of someone who's committed to their hate and committed to being right, there's really nowhere to go in that dialogue. So why bring our energy forth toward a conversation like that? At the same time, I have a sister who's on the opposite side of the political spectrum from me, complete opposite ends. And we're slowly figuring out a way how to talk about politics with each other. And it's really a willingness on both of our parts to listen to what the other person has to say.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we're not screaming and raging at each other, so it does make it easier. But we've had very heated dialogues, but at least we're trying. We're trying to hear the other's point of view. Because it's important to.
So how many times has your sister looked at you and say, "Okay, brother, show me some big love"?
No, it's true. And that's the thing. I'm like this person out there spouting love, 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 love. And look, every single time I post a political anything on my page, there's always a backlash.
I bet there is.
Even if I bring as much consciousness and as much love as I can possibly bring, it always pisses people off.
Yeah. This book, Big Love, is so inspirational. It's so heart-centered. I'm curious now about your spirituality. So do you believe in God? And if so, what does that belief look like? And probably more importantly, how does your personal spirituality affect your life and your writing?
Well, my personal spirituality, I would say, affects everything I do. And that is, again, it's rooted in love. It's rooted in the belief in love as the most powerful force we have in this world. And I would say that my belief in a divine spirit is connected to love, too. So, you know, my relationship to my belief in God has always been confusing. I've never really known exactly what I believe, and only in recent years have I become more comfortable with that, because I realize that nobody knows for sure what the reality of God is, or what you know what I mean? So, but I do feel like there's something beyond just humanity that exists in this plane. And interestingly enough, I feel that most intensely when I'm having the most loving connection with other human beings. It's almost like when I'm having the most, the greatest experience of humanity is when I feel clearest that there's some divine force at work here. And I don't look at that as a human or a being with a gray beard as much as just a spirit energy that is vibrating beyond all of this noise and busyness and division and confusion and all of this other stuff going on. There's this divine pulse that is just peace and just love.
And finally, what do you hope most readers will take away from Big Love?
You know, I hope that they will feel less alone in their journey and in their struggle, you know, reminded that we're all struggling. And I hope they'll feel a connection in me sharing my stories, that even though they're not going to relate exactly to every one of my circumstances, that I do believe that they're going to relate to the nature of humanity through my experiences. And I hope that they'll be able to connect to their own. And I also, you know, I hope people will be encouraged to choose love as a guiding force in their lives as often as possible.
Yeah, And I think this is a very important book that everyone should be reading. The book is Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart. We need that now more than ever. Scott Stabile, it's been such an honor to have you on today's program. Thank you for not only writing this book, but for sharing your light and love throughout the world.
Oh, thank you too, Richard, for everything you're doing. I'm really grateful to be here.
If you'd like to visit Scott online, then I would encourage you to do so. I love his story and I love this book. You can visit him at scottstabile.com. His last name is spelled S-T-A-B-I-L-E. And I don't know about you, but when I get a book, and I get a lot of them, we have a lot of authors on this program, one of the things I like to do is go to the very end. It seems like there's always something inspirational, the last things they write in a book. And so I'd like to share with you the last few paragraphs that Scott writes in his book, Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart. He writes, "Imagine carrying such a depth of love and compassion for humanity that no matter what someone did to you or anyone else, no matter how horrible or hurtful, you could look him or her in the eyes and with sincerity declare, 'I love you and I forgive you. I feel your pain as I feel mine, and I recognize your need to heal as much as I recognize my own. I believe that potential lives within each of us, and within that potential, miracles blossom and humanity changes.' Their daughter's murders forced the Pennsylvania Amish community to face the conviction of their beliefs, and they chose to forgive. My parents' murder forced me to face a circumstance that most, including myself, had deemed unforgivable. And yet, with a deep commitment to love, I found my way to forgiveness. What a gift it was to know I could make that choice and that I can continue to choose forgiveness moving forward. Forgiveness is one of the greatest gifts we can give ourselves and each other. It's one of the mandates of love and one of the cornerstones of freedom, mine and yours. I forgave my father for insisting that my mother work in such a dangerous environment, the same way I forgave their killer, by doing my best to put myself in my father's shoes and connect with him, not as my dad, but as another human being doing what he could to make a living and to make sense of our crazy world. He made so many awful choices as a father and a husband, but I know he never wanted harm to come to any of us, most certainly not my mom. Though I couldn't connect to many of his decisions, I could connect to his humanity, and with compassion, I forgave him. Hundreds of cars lined up at my parents' funeral. The procession stretched for blocks. My mom and dad touched many people from all walks of life. I don't think I fully understood their impact until I saw the number of family and friends who showed up to mourn them. I didn't know just how generous they had been with their support and their love. I wouldn't realize for many years that perhaps the greatest lesson they taught me by example was to accept and respect whomever crossed your path, and to be a compassionate friend to those in need. That lesson, like my parents, will live on in me forever." In closing this program, I'm going to share a couple of encore segments of some interviews that I've done. First, you're going to hear about 7 minutes worth of the great Father Richard Rohr, and then immediately following him is a segment taken out of an interview I did with Bishop John Shelby Spong. Both of those men, by the way, I think model big love, each in their own way as well. In one of your books, you wrote, "Religion has tended to create people who think they have God in their pockets, people with quick, easy, glib answers." Would you address that further? Because oftentimes these days, it seems that we're hearing those quick, easy, glib answers.
Aren't we? You know, let me put it this way. You know, they say if you want to tell a lie, tell a real big lie, and it works. And that we've been able in the West to take the biblical concept of faith, which clearly means not knowing, living without certitude, clarity, an ability to walk in darkness, an ability to walk at a deeper level of trust, and that we've been able to turn that around and make Christianity into a religion with answers for everything. It creates very inflated egos, and it's not serving religion very well at all. So I think we've turned around the basic foundational meaning of faith, which clearly meant not knowing. And now we got people who know everything, who know who's in and who's out, who's up and who's down, who's saved and who's not saved. It doesn't create the appropriate humility before mystery. And I think a sign of someone who has encountered authentic God experience is that they're always going to be humble. They're not going to be glib and smug.
Well, and that seems to be what's often lacking in activism. Even though I might support what they're doing, if you're not careful and you're not dealing with the ego, it will rise up eventually.
That's right. And that's why this is a problem as much on the left as it is on the right. And they both keep attacking the other side, thinking the devil's on the other side always. And neither side tends to see its own demons, its own, absolute certitude about what is good and what is bad. So it isn't serving us well.
Richard, what do you see as a religious leader yourself? What do you see as the top issues that we need to be addressing in this country? For so long, what we call the religious right has kind of dominated the discussion and have centered around, quote, family values, around the abortion issue, around same-sex marriage. But there is so many more issues that need to come to the forefront that have everything to do with values.
It's amazing that we've been able to create, like the two you mentioned, the homosexual issue and the abortion issue, we've been able to create two litmus tests that have not been litmus tests for the first 1900 years of Christianity. It's like, where did these come from as the proof texts of whether you're really a Christian or not? And as a Catholic who tries to honor the whole tradition, I really want to say, where did that come from? You know, it's dealing with cultural issues and purity codes and needs to feel superior and right, much more than any reliance upon the teaching of Jesus, who never talks about either of those issues, for example. Whereas almost every other story of Jesus is talking about love of the poor and concern for the poor. And so it's really rather amazing that people who consider themselves followers of Jesus have been able to ignore many of the major things that Jesus talked about.
Talk more about what I would consider the radical nature of Jesus that we often don't hear about, but I think we are now more these days, but just how radical he truly was.
That's it. We churchified, if that's a word, we churchified Jesus, and we took him out of his historical Jewish reformist context, and we pretty much made him a white middle-class American, concerned about the same issues that we're obsessed with or preoccupied with. And once you do that, once you pull him out of his Jewish context as a reformer of his own religion and therefore a reformer of all religion, I think you pretty much have domesticated Jesus. And the things that we are concerned about are very different than the much more radical concerns of his, which have to do with justice, with mercy, with good faith, as one line from the Synoptic says.
Yes, and well, and also with the poor as well.
Yeah, right on. Well, when I say justice, that's what I'd mean. Yeah, concern for the poor.
Do you see any issues overriding any others that are taking place in the world today that you deem most important?
You know, this might surprise you, and I don't know if on longer reflection I'd say the same thing, but this is what comes to my mind right now. I think our biggest problem is superficiality. Is just an amazing preoccupation with silliness, with issues of no account, with you know, the lives of movie stars, and I think this superficiality is leading us to miss the heart of most issues. because we just don't go deep.
Mm-hmm.
We settle for cliches, for one-liners, for very quick explanations for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to kill us across the board, because in every issue, there's just no depth. So that's what strikes me. You know, that's what allows us not to see the evil of war, not to see the global warming issue as a moral issue, not to see the oppression of the poor as a moral issue. It's just that we're not bad people, I don't think. We're just not very deep people.
What do you think is at the root of many of the interpretations to justify some of the bigotry and some of the hatred over the years?
Well, I think what is going on in this country is that we are in a backlash period of great fear. I go back and see it much earlier than just present time.
Mm-hmm.
I think we went through the desegregation ruling, which upset the southern way of life where most fundamentalist religion is born. Then we went through the urban riots, which made everybody in the country anxious. That was during the 60s. And then we went through the Vietnam War, which separated the generations from one another. The fathers had fought nobly under the flag in World War II, and their children were saying, hell no, we won't go. And there was great tension in this country. And then we expelled a sitting president from the White House. And whether you like Mr. Nixon or not, I think for a country to expel its elected ruler is a traumatic event for the whole country. So this anxiety has been building up, and that's when you began to get Jerry Falwell forming the Moral Majority, and Jimmy Carter, a born-again Christian, gets elected, and then 4 years later, Jimmy Carter hadn't been strong enough, so they elected Ronald Reagan, who was sort of the epitome of good guys defeating bad guys. The cowboys, or the bad guy always loses in the cowboy movie. And I think we were just beginning to get over that during the Clinton administration, 8 years, because of enormous prosperity. And Clinton, I think his personal behavior, I don't know what word to use, but his personal behavior upset an awful lot of people. His
mm-hmm.
behavior was simply not dignified, and it was offensive to a lot of people. So there was a swing back to get Mr. Bush elected president in 2000, and then the terrorist attack on 9/11 2001 created this enormous wave of anxiety. So people are running looking for security. And one of the security systems is to pretend that you possess the absolute truth of God. So you see the Roman Catholic Church becoming ultra-conservative. I mean, they've moved from John the 23rd to Cardinal Ratzinger. That's an enormous move back to the right.
Yes, it is.
And you see the Protestant churches in Christianity. Look, 30 years ago, Protestant Christianity in this country was identified with the March for Civil Rights for Black People and with the protest against the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
That's gone now. The only thing you hear about God and Christ and religion today is this group opposed to gay people, opposed to abortion, and quoting the Bible to prove that anybody that disagrees with them is wrong. I think that's an enormous shift, and I think we just got to stay the course until this anxiety begins to dissipate, and I have great confidence that this country is strong enough so that it will not move back into a reactionary thing. My sense is that when religion gets political power, it always turns demonic, because when you have political power with religious convictions, you assume that you're on God's side, so anybody that disagrees with you disagrees with God, and that's where we're headed. You know, when you want to amend the Constitution to put prejudice against gay people into it, and you keep talking about family values, once again, I'd like to know where they're being lived out, because every poll I see says that in the religious right, they get divorced as often as anybody else, they commit adultery as much as anybody else, they abuse their children as much as anybody else. So I don't know where this family values are being lived. There was a senator in Arkansas who was elected on the family values routine, a Republican senator backed by the religious right, and he left his wife and married his secretary about 6 months before he was up for re-election, and he was not re-elected. I just want to know where the values are being lived out. I'm not interested in your rhetoric, especially if your rhetoric is hate-filled. Bad religion always has a victim that they're running against. and they have hold of what I'd call partial truths.
Mm-hmm.
Abortion, for example, is a terribly complex issue. I don't know anybody that's really pro-abortion.
Right.
I'm pro-life, but I'm in favor of abortions being legal
mm-hmm.
and safe, because I think if you're pro-life, you've got to think about the lives of women who are going to get abortions from back alley butchers if they don't have it legal and safe. And I think we ought to do everything we can to make abortions very rare, but make them safe and legal. But I would favor anything to make them rare as well as safe and legal. And, you know, the idea that you're pro-death if you're not in favor of stopping abortion, I just think that's the wrong way to go.
You just heard some encore segments of interviews that I did with a couple of my favorite spiritual teachers, Father Richard Rohr and Bishop John Shelby Spong. And as today's program, once again, I want to thank my special guest, Scott Stabile. The book is Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart. I want to thank you for joining me. A reminder that all shows are podcast on my site, richardbrendan.com. And so, for engineer Genesis Brown and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.